Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everyone. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our week in review. There's a lot to talk about today. And joining us now is Jim Sturgis. He's executive director of the Pioneer Institute, the Boston-based think tank. And Jim, always great to have you. Welcome
back.
Good
to be here.
And David Boeri, senior reporter here at WBUR. David, so many thanks to you for coming in as well.
Absolutely, Anthony. Pleasure.
So let's begin with big questions about access to mental health care in Massachusetts following the deadly stabbing spree in Taunton that left three people dead, including the alleged assailant, 28-year-old Arthur J. DeRosa. Tuesday night, he attacked a number of people, stabbing several of them, two of them fatally, before an off-duty sheriff's deputy, James Creed, shot and killed him at a Bertucci's restaurant in Taunton. Here's Bristol County District Attorney Thomas Quinn.
His sister has indicated that he was acting in a disturbed manner and making irrational statements earlier on Monday, and she suggested to him that he needed to seek help.
Now, his family, DeRosa's family, confirmed that he'd been admitted to an ER the night before his attacks for claiming to have sort of some mental issues, but he was released the next morning. Here's his aunt, Liz DeRosa, at a press conference in the middle of the week.
AJ is not a terrorist. He was someone's child. His children had to grow up now without him because Morton let him out without the proper treatment.
So among the questions raised by the family is, why did they release him? Jim, I'll start with you on this. What's your initial reaction about this? Does this look like just a case of, I mean, a very tragic case of what were the mental health services that were needed?
I start by just saying I think we all need to step back and ask for a little more information. The fact is that Morton Hospital still cannot describe for folks what role the state-run, the DMH, the Department of Mental Health-run unit played in making a determination about whether to release or not. People have said, well, you know, he had a record. Well, his record has been pretty clean for the past 6 years. It's not really, you know, we're all rushing to look for explanations for a tragedy like this. And what I think is popping up really is a war between, war is a bit strong, but there's this battle over public opinion about whether it's Morton Hospital's fault or whether it's the state's fault. And I think we should just kind of step back here for a sec.
Yeah. David, your initial response.
I agree with Jim. It's not the time right now. It seems like it's too broad an indictment of our mental health system on too little information here. You know, predictions of violence at when it occurs are always, always difficult. They've stumped criminologists for a long time. We clearly need more mental health services in this state for people, and beginning a lot earlier than crisis time. Why he did what he did at the time he did it is a mystery. So we do need more information here, but we also need attention on mental health for a far longer period of time. And also, this is the other issue that plagues people is victims' rights, and that the key part of victims' rights being that you need to show, you need to prove, you need to meet a standard that person presents a clear threat to himself in order to institutionalize him.
Mm. Well, we spoke earlier this week to former commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health, Marcia Fowler. She spoke to us on Radio Boston earlier this week about this issue. Here's what she had to say.
I mean, I think the larger issue is that there simply is not enough mental health services available to people who need them in the community in particular. Typically, people present to mental health professionals when they're in acute crisis. And we really need to put services in place that either are preventive or that provide behavioral health screening.
So, David, you were making pretty much that point.
Yeah, I mean, is there an interaction between mental illness and crime? You know, crime, that is, if you can show that people are conscious and aware of what they're doing and have control. Is there a connection? Of course there is. And the system is, it is rich, unfortunately, with lots of mental illness amongst people in jails, in prisons, and out on the streets. That's a challenge.
Yeah. One point that Marcia Fowler made to us about this issue, by the way, that I think bears repeating, and that is people who are ill with mental health issues are much more often the victims of crime than the perpetrators of crime. And I think it's really, really important to put this fact out there,
Anthony,
in a story like this.
Sure, I agree. And you know what I'd say is, instead of looking back to, let's say, Arthur's his background, his experience with the correctional facilities as a justification or as an explanation here, we might want to look at when people present to the correctional facilities, when they enter that system, there should be better mental screening. To David's point, that's a place where maybe he 6 years ago he could have been identified in some early intervention. There are also some great models. I mean, Plymouth, there's Beth Israel, Deaconess Plymouth, Peter Holden down there is working with all these different institutions from schools to the law enforcement folks to provide a coordinated set of services to make sure that folks, once they come to the ER, don't immediately get released into a situation where they could just fall into some sort of criminal activity or similar. So we need to have better coordination. I wouldn't doubt we need more services, but I think the coordination, the models, is maybe even more important.
There's a lot of heartache, Anthony, amongst lots of families over the well-being of their loved ones who are in trouble, but cannot be shown to present a clear, immediate danger so that they can be institutionalized by their families. Doesn't happen, can't happen.
Now, speaking of heartache, I just want to mention three names because, of course, we don't want to lose in all of this the real tragedy that befell at least a couple of families here. 80-year-old Patricia Slavin died that evening. Her and her daughter opened the door to this man, allegedly, in an effort to help him. And of course, there was George Heath, who died trying to protect a waitress in the midst of this. And James Creed, the off-duty deputy, Plymouth County Sheriff's deputy, who actually shot the assailant and ended this rampage. So those are names that our hearts go out to them. Sad story, lots of grist for thought, and we'll move on to another story. And David, you followed this very closely, and this is a story about possible excessive use of force by police in Nashua, New Hampshire. News cameras caught this disturbing scene at the end of a 60-mile car chase in Nashua earlier this week. Videos show a suspect, Richard Simone, climbing out of his truck, dropping to his knees to surrender when officers move in and start punching him repeatedly. New Hampshire Attorney General Joseph Foster has launched an investigation into whether police used excessive force against Simone, who was wanted on assault and larceny charges. Here's Governor Charlie Baker after seeing the footage yesterday.
I thought the video was incredibly disturbing, and I'm anxious to work with the folks in New Hampshire to get moving on the investigation and to figure out what as quickly as possible and take the appropriate action.
Now, a New Hampshire state police officer was put on paid leave yesterday pending the investigation. A Massachusetts state trooper has also been temporarily relieved of duty. David, you were in New Hampshire yesterday. I know we got to talk to you about this yesterday. What's sort of the latest? What's developed since then?
Well, there's a hearing today. It should be taking place now, an internal hearing in Massachusetts concerning that Massachusetts trooper. And it's called a duty status hearing. There are four options for him. And I spoke to an attorney who represents state troopers in the state. He said of the four possibilities, and this is only a status consideration while the full investigation is carried out, but he said of the four possibilities, I believe the worst is going to come to this trooper, which is suspension without pay, because the probable cause is easily met in this case by that video. There's not a lot of uncertainty. The governor is making a pretty categorical statement here, and that's because there are five or six videos, all from different angles, all from overhead. It's clear. It's pretty clear what happened.
Right. This guy's down on his knees, and the punching seems to last anywhere from 11 to 17 seconds. There doesn't seem, Jim, to be much sort of gray area in how to interpret this.
No, I don't think there is. Look, I think it's understandable. We all understand that adrenaline is running. This individual, Richard Simone, put officers at risk, put the general public at risk. It was an hour-long chase, got all of that. But the fact is, there were six or seven helicopters flying above. They can hear the helicopters, and notwithstanding that, and they know that there are cameras trained on them, this was the reaction. I mean, it's a big issue around self-control, and if you don't have those who are in uniforms who can control themselves when they're carrying guns, it's a pretty dangerous thing.
That's the standard. That is the professional standard. That's why we spend so much time training police officers, and especially at the state police academies, because that's what's called for. It's the ability to discipline oneself, to be able to manage the adrenaline. And in this case, that didn't happen.
Yeah. Let's hear from New Hampshire State Police Colonel Robert Quinn, who spoke about this yesterday. Here's a bit of what he said.
I want the public and law enforcement personnel to know that the Division of State Police does not condone the unjustified use of force, and it will not be tolerated.
But David, I mean, I know it's early, and I know it sort of seems fair to say that you look at this video from five different angles and you can't sort of come up with a justification for it in any way, a justification for this kind of beating. But what explains it? I mean, what are people saying?
Well, it is two things. In the old days, this was common. Perpetrator puts people through a lot of stress. A lot of those state troopers and local cops are traveling behind him at close to 100 miles an hour. They have been put through the ringer. They're pumped up. And in days of old, there was a beatdown. That was the punishment for a perp on the street before you hauled him in. Well, we don't do things that way. It's a different world. And yes, there's a lot of adrenaline, but again, it's the professional standard. It's the professional standard, and that is why our state police and our police and state police heroes are heroes, because they go beyond. They do what we're supposed to do and refrain from what we're not supposed to do.
Right. You know, Jim, it's interesting because one of the debates out there is whether police should be equipped with body cameras. Boston police will soon be wearing body cameras as part of a 6-month pilot program. Think that's a good idea? I mean, is this a reminder about the importance of the idea of body cameras? Because the idea, one of the things is it would restrain this kind of apparently illegal activity.
Look, body cameras are coming. And viral video taken by people, whether it's media or individuals in the street, is there. And I think that the police are well aware of this, and in their training programs are trying to think about how to make sure we train for that professional standard that David was talking about. It's a different kind of training. It's a different kind of self-control.
Yeah, it really is. Well, let's move on to legislative matters. Yesterday, the Massachusetts State Senate overwhelmingly approved a transgender rights bill. The measure bans discrimination against transgender people in public places such as sports arenas, movie theaters, and restaurants. It also allows people to use the restroom or locker room that corresponds to their gender identity rather than their physical anatomy. And the bill now moves on to the House. So here's State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz, who introduced the bill.
It's about civil rights, it's about justice, and it doesn't require a lot of complicated language and legislative, pretzel twisting in order to effectuate what we're talking about. It's a simple matter.
So, Jim, Massachusetts passes this law. It's often at the forefront of sort of civil rights style legislation. It comes at a time when there's big national debate about this. The federal government is chiming in on this issue. What's your take?
Well, my take is how the bill gets structured and how we think about this going forward is really important. Probably disagree with the senator on that. Look, the civil rights call on this one's pretty easy. I mean, if you think about someone who is transitioning gender and thinking about using the men's room at a hockey game or a rock concert, you might understand how uncomfortable the person might be and might feel at risk, right? On the other side, you do have issues, especially where children are concerned, especially when you're dealing with public schools. And if you're talking about a locker room in a school where kids actually disrobe and take showers and that sort of thing, and I think we should show some respect for that. That said, in the context of a bathroom and access to a bathroom, transgender people are using the bathrooms right now and don't present a greater risk because of a law that's passed. What I would say that I do think people should think about, and I don't mean to compare this to the Americans with Disability Act to draw a comparison between the two issues, but just to say, when the 1990 Act was passed, we had to think about how we restructured, how we rethought our sidewalks and made sure that people had access. And what I would tell you is in the setting of a public school where we have risk-averse institutions, they will move headlong to single-use, single-occupant bathrooms. That's going to take investment. And we've seen already the private market, lots of, your Starbucks and other places like that have already moved in that direction, Target and all of them. This is new infrastructure. But our older institutions that have infrastructure that's more communal, I think we're probably going to see that move along.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. David, what's your response?
We're going to see this whole issue inflamed now. We already have today. I mean, the right, the evangelical right, has come out in force. Here's one from Texas, a quote: "This is going to be the biggest issue facing families and schools in America since prayer was taken out of the public schools." Hmm. A lot of reaction in Texas today against this, calling this a full-out war, a cultural war. What's not clear, and what has to be what we're going to see cases about, it coming down the line, in fact, there's some in the system now, is whether sexual discrimination laws or anti-discrimination laws apply in matters of gender identity. There's a case in front of the appeals court in the Fourth Circuit in Virginia right now in which the United States was upheld in a case against a school board in Gloucester County, Virginia. It determined that court by a 2-1 vote determined that the transgender boy seeking to use the boys' restroom was going to be allowed and accommodated. So they've won that at this point, but now opponents are seeking a full review by the circuit court. This is going to wind its way through the courts, and it's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be resolved soon, especially since now the president has been using his powers as president, not necessarily laws, but his powers to try and push this agenda forward.
Yeah, and by this you're talking about the Obama administration has informed school districts around the country just today, telling them to allow students to use bathrooms corresponding to their gender identity. Right?
And what they've done, they've noted that this is not the law, we're doing this, but they're threatening the cutoff in Title IX funds, mm-hmm. in fact, if the schools don't do this. So he's using powers. This has been opposed in the courts. He's won some. He's lost some on this approach of using his powers to push non-legislation forward, so to speak, that brings more equality and less discrimination in these issues.
Well, let's hear a little bit from an opponent. Opponents refer to this as the bathroom bill. Here's Andrew Beckwith, president of the Massachusetts Family Institute, speaking to WBUR this morning.
No child should be forced into an intimate setting, like a restroom or locker room, with a person of the opposite sex. Protecting young children from exposure to members of the opposite sex in these settings is not only legal, it's an important duty of officials and parents.
Jim, it seems like, I mean, I think it was you that mentioned sort of cultural wars reigniting. It's an election season. I mean, how do you see this playing out, particularly in this sort of heated election season?
I think it probably will be a pretty big issue. I guess, you know, this is maybe a diversion, so forgive me for it.
Yeah.
I understand that this issue affects people and is an important issue for many on both sides of it. But what I would say is in the time that we're in, we're well into the civil rights movement. I wish we would also start thinking about some bigger issues as well, like the 100,000 kids who are in underperforming schools. So I guess what I'd say is I wish it wasn't as big of an issue as it is, but it is. And I think probably we should move on to some big, big issues.
Right. Well, it certainly does exist as an issue because it's being used as a political issue. You know, when a candidate on the Republican side, Ted Cruz, talks about grown men should being allowed in little girls' rooms, when he compares Trump and Clinton, said they're both in favor of this. This drives it forward. But what strikes me is how fast the change has come in our lifetimes. In the last decades, we've gone to gay marriage, gays serving in the military, lots of anti-discrimination laws now in terms of public accommodation. This is coming fast. There is a certain part of the population, to be sure, that is pushing against it. There are court challenges, but we are in this process of change, and it's going forward. And I'm not sure, Jim, that you get to those other issues while all this is rolling.
All right. But I think I'm going to take Jim's point in that we, in this segment, should move on, because there's at least one other issue that I want to talk about, and that is the cautious optimism that now surrounds the long-delayed, much-debated, massively overpriced, now much-reduced Green Line extension, which would push T-Service an extra 5 miles into Somerville and Medford. Now, with the projected cost swelling by $1 billion to over $3 billion, state transportation officials were considering killing it, but after the plan was scaled down, with smaller stations, a shorter bike path, the T's Fiscal Control Board voted to move forward with the project. Here's State Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack.
The Green Line extension is moving ahead, but in a way that is responsible and in a way that the boards can keep accountability for it in their hands.
And here's Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone, a big booster of the extension, applauding the decision to move forward.
The vote is unanimous to support the project, move it forward, and you know what, it's a great day for it, but we got to keep working at it.
So, Jim, I'd like to come to you on this just to start off. This project has been talked about for so long, on again, off again, too expensive, not ambitious enough. Now it seems to be sort of lurching forward again. What do you think? Is it going to happen? Should it happen? What's your view on this?
It's going to happen. There's $1 billion in federal funding. It's going to happen.
Right.
But I would say that this is a...
already something like $700,000 of state funds sunk into it as well. Right?
Million. would say is this is the...
$700 million.
The poster child for why we can't have good things in Massachusetts, in the sense that we already own the rights of way. All right. This is not a long project.
Yeah.
There are no new tunnels to build. There's a flyover, but it's not a very complex project. L.A. just did a project like this for just over $900 million, and they had to build tunnels, and tunnels are really expensive.
Right. As we learned in this city, right?
And we have peeled all, like, the stations now are platforms, and, you know, we realize that we're about $200 million worth of savings is because we're not going to pay as many consultants. You know, it's a really strange project in that sense, and I do hope, I think one of the things that Stephanie Pollack did say, the secretary did say, which I think is really important, is we should learn a lesson from the Big Dig, which is we allowed for contractors to run wild because we didn't have the talent inside to manage them and get out of them what we wanted. They need to have a real leadership team on this that is reporting to the public frequently to make sure that we keep the public on board for it.
Yeah. What's your view on this, Dave?
You know, it's so clear that we need more mass transit. Absolutely. On the other hand, you just take a look at what the problem is here in a system that is struggling just to reach acceptable levels of service right now. My experts on this are my daughter and her friends. I hear from my daughter every day, and here's what she said. It's never on time. There always seems to be a mechanical issue. A lot of stations don't have handicap access. They keep increasing fares with no signs of improvements. They've spread themselves too thin. They've got to make things better before they expand. And this is what Stephanie Pollack acknowledged. I think the governor acknowledges they got to make the existing system better. It is pathetic. They struggled. They got billions of dollars in repairs that are backlogged. And so they talk about extending
the line.
But Jim,
isn't this an argument against sort of moving forward on something like this? I mean, the system isn't working yet now.
Yeah, no, it definitely is an argument against it. And Frank, my organization has argued against expansions. This is the one exception that we think makes sense. And it's simply because it does add so much value to the region. And the other thing is that we do think that the core system right now is in a state of, it's improving because of all the changes that we are making. There's much more money going into the core system. We're not even close. A train derailed this morning at Park Street, right? I mean, yeah. We've got a long way to go.
And Jim, you're right. There's also the $1 billion, and that pushes it. There's $1 billion if we go forward. But still, I look at this stripped-down system, those five stations may not even have roofs. And so they're doing this, and they're already doing it and scaling it back. So it's already a sort of an unimpressive system that they're struggling mightily just to afford. Mm-hmm. We need more mass transit, but it's not. This is an agonizing story.
I've got one more question about this because, and here's what I'm puzzled by, and we talked to Rafael Maris, Vice President of the Conservation Law Foundation, about this, and he reminded us that the extension is legally required as part of mitigation to the environmental mitigation to the big dig. So, in that sense, doesn't this have to happen, Jim?
It does have to happen. The CLF has been, I think, very good at working the levers of state government. That was actually approved the last day of the Dukakis administration, sort of on the way out, right? But, you know, this is a good project for the region. It's a really good project from the perspective of housing, from the perspective of development, job creation, all the rest. It has ridership. So it has all the good things. The fact is, we've never wanted to think in a different way. I mean, we're building a maintenance facility, just as one example. It makes really little sense. There are places like L.A. and Toronto that have done very different things. They contracted out all their maintenance. They actually have to build a facility. Instead, we want to build it all.
All right. Well, gentlemen, we are out of time, but great having you in here this week. And I want to thank Jim Sturgis. He's executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, thanks for coming in, talking about the Week in Review, and have a great weekend.
Same to you.
And David Boeri, senior reporter for WBUR. David, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anthony. My pleasure.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, we're going to talk to Congressman Seth Moulton about his views of U.S. policy in Iraq. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.